It's good to be here tonight, and it's my privilege to be able to talk with you this evening about what I have titled The Current State of the Church. When I first was asked to make this presentation, I was asked to talk about the condition of the church today and how the condition that we currently face transpired over the past 63 years. During that period of time, I have been at least a part of some of the events that have occurred and a witness to many others. I first started preaching when I was 15 years of age and have been doing that ever since. So if you can add 63 and 15, you know how old I am. That's the first clue that I pass out tonight. But anyway, I want to talk to you about some of the events that have occurred that actually make us who we are and what we are. I've always been interested in history. I think history is one of the greatest teachers there is. And when you look at history, you're able to see your mistakes, you're able to see your successes, and of course your failures. And if we learn from history, we're the better for it. If we don't learn from history, then we're doomed to make the same mistakes again. And often that's what we do. We make the same mistakes over and over. I've divided the presentation into three areas. I first want to talk to you about growth so far as the past years are concerned. And then we're going to talk about the subject of division and its impact on the church. And then we're going to talk about recent events that challenge the church today. I have in my possession a church directory dated 1949 to 1951. And in that directory, there were 195 churches that were using one cup and no Sunday school classes. Of that 195 congregations, only 126 continue to meet today, which means that 69 no longer exist. They have died or fallen by the wayside in the past 63 years. In my study of growth, I found out that in 1955, we had 217 churches in America. In 1958, we had 250. In 1961, 291. In 1993, from 1961, a period of 22 years, we jumped from 291 churches to 429 churches. That was a jump or an increase of 138 congregations. In 2014, we had 432, which means that in the last 21 years, we have increased in only three churches. So in the past 20 years, we've not grown very much. And we don't have very many churches, new churches that have been established in America to account for what has happened during this period of time. I want to break that down just a little farther because in doing that, we get a good picture of the geographical makeup of not only the country, but where the churches are in our country. For example, in Alabama, in 1949, we had five churches. Today, we have 14. Arkansas, we had 10. We have 23 today. In California, and this is an interesting statistic, we had 33 churches. Today, we have only 39 churches. Not much of an increase in that state. Colorado had two. Today, we have five. Florida, two. Today, 11. Georgia, four. Today, 8. Illinois, 4. Today, 6. Iowa, 2. Today, 5. Kentucky, 2. Today, 6. Kansas, 2. Today, 6. Kentucky, 3. Today, 13. Louisiana, 5. Today, 13. Michigan, 1. Today, 3. Mississippi, 6. Today, 9. Missouri, 22. Today, 55. New Mexico, 1. Then and now. Oklahoma, 27. Then. Today, 43. Oregon 1, today 8, Pennsylvania 7, today 9, South Carolina 1, today 3, Tennessee 6, today 15, Texas 39, today 79, Virginia 1, today 3, Washington 2, today 6, West Virginia 16, today. Now it's very indicative of the fact that in this account, The major portion of our churches lie in Texas, Oklahoma, and Missouri, right through the center of the country. When you begin to spread out and get a picture of what exists in the other parts of the United States, in many states the church is non-existent, who meet and worship as we do, and in many of the other states there are not very many congregations. Now the question that we, I think, need to ask is, why is that the case? Is it that we have failed to evangelize in those areas? Or is it that the people in those areas do not are not receptive as they are in other parts of the country? There have been times in America when things changed. For example, when the automobile industry was booming, people left many of these states and moved to Michigan. During that period of time, there were a number of congregations in Michigan, a number of them, and around the Detroit area, especially Pontiac area. And then when that began to wane, people moved out of there and they moved back to where they had originally lived. And then, of course, that caused a decrease in the congregations that were there. Today, in 2014, we have at least one church in 32 states. In 1951, we had at least one congregation in 24 states. And so when you stop and think about where we were, where we are, some of these figures are really pretty disappointing and really indicate that maybe we have done a lot but accomplished very little. A significant number of the churches in the church directory today are very small and they need help to survive. In many of those congregations, a different speaker is called in every Sunday to give the lesson with no one in the church teaching locally and no one in the congregation being developed. Now, I see great problems in that. Here's where I think history can teach us a lesson and where we can learn a very valuable lesson. These speakers who leave to go help these different churches, number one, are absent from the church where they hold membership. And at least on that Sunday, they are of no value to the local church. Many of them, many of the same men, are gone maybe 2-3 Sundays a month. And so they're never at their home congregation except maybe once a month, and they're at a different church every other Sunday during that month. The real disturbing thing is the fact that these men who go and preach at these places have no real plan for developing teachers in that church. They merely go preach for them. And then someone comes the next Sunday and preaches for them, and so on. No program, no plan is ever advanced that will help that congregation struggling to train its own teachers or to have teachers. Now, someone might say, well, you know, that's due to a number of different things. But I would like to suggest that instead of men just going and preaching at a congregation so that someone is there every Sunday, that speaker do go to that congregation every Sunday and start a program to develop talent in the church. Do something directly pointed at developing teachers. And if not that, then if there's a different speaker every month, then all of those speakers get together and combine their efforts at developing the church. Now, I say that because if that's not done, that church is going to die. Just as surely as the people age, the day will come when you lock the church house, and the church no longer exists. That's happening every year among us. I know of at least one that's closed within the last month, and there will be others that are going to close simply because they're not able to exist. Within 10 years, if you look at the statistical data that we have as to the number of churches we have, it will be very plain and very clear that we are on the decline. And the first churches to go will be these weak churches that don't have any teachers. Now, there's another possibility here. In the field of education, years ago, counties consolidated. Everybody likes to talk about the one-room schoolhouse where people used to go and learn. And they came up with the idea that we could do a much better job if we consolidated all of these little one-room schools into one school. We could have more teachers, better training, And that has been the formula followed by educational circles for a number of years now. And in some areas, I believe that is a good idea when it comes to the church. I know of a place right now where a congregation has maybe two members, and a brother from another congregation less than 15 miles away goes to teach for them twice a month, leaving a congregation with about 12 to 15 members. Now, it seems to me that logic would demand that those both congregations be much better if there were one church, if there were one congregation. At least as one congregation, they could all be together on the Lord's Day and improve their chances of development and growth. I really believe, to be honest with you, that the state of the church in America is in a state of decline numerically. I think we have to confront that fact. I even go so far as to say to you, unless there are drastic changes, the future of the Lord's church lies mainly in foreign lands rather than in America, if there is not some kind of drastic change. We know what goes on in areas where we've sent preachers overseas. And we know how churches are multiplying, and so are the number of people in congregations. Here we struggle, and we are struggling. And either we do one of two things. We either continue to do what we've been doing and get the same results that we've been getting, or we try to come up with some scriptural, ingenious way of actually making our churches stronger and giving help where it is needed in such a way as to improve the condition of the church rather than just to get by for a period of time. If we do not correct what currently exists so far as growth is concerned in our nation, then we're going to continue to see a decline. Now, another reason that we have some churches that otherwise we didn't have is division. You know, in one city, maybe 10, 20 years ago, we had one congregation. In that same city today, we may have three congregations, and what we did was take that one congregation, divide it into three groups with three different buildings, because we had a division here, a division there. Many of the congregations that we start and have started in the last several years did not start because we were evangelizing. They started because we were dividing. They started because we couldn't get along with each other. And as a result of that, we have more congregations, not necessarily more members, but we have more congregations. Two major divisions have occurred in One Cup churches in the last 75 to 80 years. When I began preaching and holding meetings 63 years ago, the landscape of our brotherhood was far different than it is today. The first major division that we suffered was over what was called the order of worship controversy. The idea had been advanced a number of years before that Acts 2:42 revealed a specified order in which the items of worship were to be observed. That was first advocated by a man by the name of F.W. Emmons, who lived in Emmaus, Indiana. His writings appeared in the Christian Preacher of 1936, and the title of the article was On the Ancient Order of Things in Public Worship. There were some people, after reading that article, went along with Emmons on his contention, such men as Alfred L. Moore, who agreed with what he said. Other men, like Nathan J. Rice, who lived in Pennsylvania and circulated among the churches in that area, opposed the idea and didn't believe that Acts 2:42 was actually as prescribed order of worship. W.J. Rice, I think from the state of West Virginia, published a little paper called The Gospel Missionary. And he was a very serious advocate of the order of worship attached to Acts 2:42. And he later joined with Dr. G.A. Trott and H.C. Harper and founded the Apostolic Way. Brother Rice was considered a hardliner on the order of worship. After Harper left the Apostolic Way, in 1928 he's founded the Truth that later became the Old Paths Advocate in 1932. J.D. Phillips was an editor both of the Truth and also of the Old Paths Advocate, and he was convinced that Emmons was right on the order of worship, and so he advocated that that order be adopted by every congregation. In reality, there really were very few who really adopted it. Even though the issue was hotly debated and even though it was preached from both sides, there were really very few numerically that ever adopted the order itself. Homer King, of course, opposed the idea, but he did agree that if brethren were convinced that that order should be used, there would be nothing wrong with them using that, and therefore, if they wanted to adopt the order, that would be fine. He did not believe, however, that any church should be pressed into adopting the order. Now, that seemed like a rather logical way to approach a problem, because nobody, so far as I know, believed that there was anything wrong with aligning the items of worship in a particular order, like Acts 2:42, or any other order, so far as that was concerned. And so if churches were left to make their own decision, it would seem that everybody would do that, and we'd be able to get along. But Brother Phillips wasn't really ready to allow that because he believed that it had to be that way. On the other side, Brother Homer Gay took a more active position in opposing the order. And the disagreements ultimately resulted in a division on the editorial staff of the Old Paths Advocate and finally in the overall brotherhood of One Cup Churches. The division was foolish, the division was wasteful, the division didn't need to happen. It served as a major blow to the progress of our brotherhood. And it served as a major blow to the growth of churches in many areas. Most of the churches that adopted the order were in the eastern part of the United States. And there really was never a wide-scale acceptance of it anywhere else in the country, and even not a wide-scale acceptance of it in the east. Today, there are only about 10 or 12 congregations listed in the church directory that observe the order of Acts 2:42. And there are very few of them. I would say maybe less than five who believe it has to be that way. Many of them choose to follow it merely because that's what they've always done. They often go off and worship at places where they don't use the order. So it's not that they believe it has to be. It's just that they believe they choose to be. It was truly a division that never should have happened, like most divisions, by the way. Never should have happened. But for some reason, it did. It really accomplished nothing worthwhile. It set the church back, and it limited both our influence and our progress in the world at that time, which I believe should teach us today that we need to be very careful about dividing. We need to be very careful about allowing trouble, problems, subjects, and situations to arise in congregations that cause us to become divided, split the church. And unfortunately, when that happens, people are not satisfied to keep it at home. It spreads. The rumors spread. The talk spread. And as a result, it can become a major problem. If we could only learn from the past, we might be able to avoid in the future some of the pitfalls that have limited our influence in the world. When I first started to preach, there was a lot of talk about divorce and remarriage. There really wasn't much divorce in the world at that time. If you go back to the 40s, early 40s especially, you didn't read about divorce. Even people in Hollywood didn't get divorces. It was just something you didn't read about, something you didn't hear about. But times were beginning to change. And as times began to change, you heard about it more, you read about it more. I well remember very vividly the first case we ever had in the church in Fort Worth. There was a woman there who was a member of the church who had married a man who was not a member of the church, but he had been divorced prior to their marriage. It created a rumble. It created some dissatisfaction, and there was some discussion about it. Didn't split the church, we didn't divide, and there really was no major problem, but it was talked about. Not only was it talked about there, but it was beginning to be talked about all over our brotherhood, especially in the state of Texas, especially in central Texas. There were people who had come to the conclusion, and they definitely believed that there was no reason whatsoever for divorce and remarriage. They had concluded, many of them without proper study, that Matthew 19:9 was a part of the law of Moses, some kind of a repetitive statement that belonged to the law of Moses and therefore did not apply to people today. The early skirmishes that took place in central Texas. Many of them really had never studied the matter because it had never been a serious challenge or a serious problem. There had been no in-depth study. Some even claim that everybody had always believed there was no exception. That's not true. There are many articles in the papers of ages gone by, early papers that were published during the Restoration period, where the position was taken by the writer that Matthew 19:9 did apply today, and there was one justifiable cause for divorce and remarriage. To contend that the Brotherhood was united on this issue, as some have, is really false and misleading. Some of them used to say, well, the Brotherhood always opposed divorce. Well, that may be true in one way, but the Brotherhood as a unit didn't always believe that you couldn't get a divorce for one reason. In fact, they believed, many of them, that you could. I was just beginning to preach when the matter became really a hot issue. Those opposing divorce for any reason were H.C. Welch Sr., Barney Welch, Fred Kerbo, Homer Gay, Merwin Buffington, and a number of others. None of them in the early days of this thought about dividing the church, and none of them in the early days, I really believed, had the idea that it would become the battle that it eventually became. However, as divorce became more common, the battle became more intensified. It was about this time that Irvin Waters, Clovis Cook, Homer King, and a host of others who contended that there was an exception and one reason why people could divorce and remarry began to let that be known. In fact, during this period of time, even though the disagreement continued, it did not become a matter of division for another 20 or 30 years. It became a matter of discussion. It became a matter of disagreement, but it really didn't become a matter of division. If you've ever traveled down Interstate 44 from Springfield to St. Louis, and you go through Lebanon, Interstate 44 ran right through the property of H.E. Robertson. And so he sold his property to the state in order to build that highway and relocated to Springfield, Missouri. After he moved to Springfield, Missouri, he started worshiping with the Benton Avenue congregation. And in that congregation, there was a man and his wife who had been converted out of the world. One or both of them had been divorced prior to their obedience to the gospel, and they were using this man in the services of the church. Well, the discussion and dissension over divorce and remarriage had reached the point that many people had settled on the idea that you could not do it, while others had settled on the idea that you could. Brother Robertson had settled on the idea that you just couldn't do it. It was wrong to do it. And so some of his friends, I suppose gently, told him that he actually was permitting what he was condemning. If he could worship in Springfield with someone who was being used that had been divorced and remarried, how could he go to a church and preach it's wrong to do that? And they began to press and push him to do something about it. Those were the very initial stages of what eventually culminated in the division over divorce and remarriage. We as a brotherhood disagreed over that subject for years without any division. We discussed that for years without any division. I've always believed, and I will contend so long as I live, that if Brother Homer Gay had not died when he did, unexpectedly, the division never would have occurred. Anyway, soon. He had enough influence in the Brotherhood to prohibit that. Even though he didn't himself believe that that was possible, he believed it was wrong to divide the church over it. And he believed it was wrong for trouble to arise over it. He was respected. And he was respected to the point that I don't believe it ever would have happened as long as he lived. When he died, however, there was no one really to oppose the division. In other words, they were willing to go along with it. And consequently, little by little, churches began to divide. Brother Robertson and his family and several others left the church in Springfield and started meeting in another place. Now, the difference between brethren over whether Matthew 19:9 applies or not is one issue. The question about whether or not we can fellowship one another, if we differ, is another question. After they left the Benton Avenue Church and started another congregation, they still would call on people like me. I went over there and attended a meeting that Fred Kerbo was holding, and Fred called on me to lead in prayer. The church had divided, but they hadn't withdrawn from me at that point, or anybody else that differed with them on the subject. However, that was soon to come. Not too long after that, they began to advocate the idea, we can no longer support or have fellowship with those people who believe that Matthew 19:9 applies today and who believe in divorce and remarriage. Doesn't matter that they've never been divorced and remarried. In fact, when I moved to Springfield in 1966, one of the first things I did was go to Brother Robertson and say, listen, let's work this thing out. How can we work together as two churches? He said, there's only one way. You've got to change your position on Matthew 19:9. I said, Brother Robertson, I've never been divorced. I don't ever plan to get a divorce. He said, you believe you could, though. And as long as you believe that, we can't fellowship you. And that was the end of the matter. And so that idea was advocated, and it spread throughout the brotherhood, or at least in various parts of the brotherhood. And that's what actually brought about not only the division over the question, but also it brought about a division over whether or not we could fellowship people who differed or disagreed with us. And by the way, that still exists today, and I'll get to that in just a minute. That really hasn't evaporated or gone away. In 1963, at my insistence, we had a study in the city of Springfield inviting various preachers to come and let's discuss these issues and see if we can iron them out and see if we cannot get together. There were a number of preachers who came. The only way Brother Robertson would agree to the meeting would be if Irvin Waters and E.H. Miller were neither one allowed to attend. In order to have the meeting, neither one of them could attend. That was a problem with me, but I felt like the possibility of resolving the issue was greater than that problem, and so we had the meeting anyway. Neither of them came. They both understood, and they both were willing to stay out. And we discussed that for about 3 or 4 days. People from all over the United States had come. We obviously ended in failure. We were unable to erase the problems and the difficulties that existed among us. And as a result of that, the division continued. From that point forward, the division widened, and the likelihood of any union between the groups ceased to exist. Today, there are 60 congregations, about 60 congregations listed in our church directory who hold the no exception position. These churches, of course, are divided among themselves. They are divided not only on how to deal with Matthew 19:9, but they're also divided on whether or not they can have any fellowship with those of us who differ from them. The hardliners refuse any type of association with those of us who accept Matthew 19:9 and divorce for fornication. Others who are less hardline will associate with those of us who disagree with them, and a few will actually call on us to participate in church services. The Light Group, or the group out in Texas that publishes The Light, seems to me to be the most hard line of all the groups. Then there's a group that I'll call the Turtle Group, and they publish a paper called The Turtle. That's why I call them the Turtle Group. But they publish a paper called The Turtle. They're somewhat less hard line, especially on the subject of fellowship. There are a number of differing views among them as to how to deal with the four Gospels and the applicability of Matthew 19:9 in particular. But the interesting thing, and the point I want to make, if you forget everything I've said, the point I really want to make is this. The division did not eliminate divorce. The division didn't eradicate the problem. We've still got the problem. They have the problem. Their children are divorcing. Their grandchildren are divorcing. And they admit that. They realize that even though they preach what they believe to be the truth and refuse to fellowship those of us that they believe teach the opposite of that, has not solved the divorce problem. And what we really should have done to begin with was try and resolve the divorce problem rather than divide over the question. Division accomplished absolutely nothing so far as the sanctity of marriage was concerned among some people. They are united on the idea that there is no scriptural divorce, but they are badly divided on how they reach that conclusion. Now, Brother George Batty later on in this study is going to be talking about their arguments. But you'll find from his presentation that they don't all take the same position to get rid of that verse and say that that verse doesn't apply today. My belief is this: division does not answer the divorce problem. And we would have been a whole lot better off 30, 40 years ago if we had come together as a brotherhood and tried to resolve the divorce problem rather than arguing over what passages of Scripture applied and didn't apply and then excommunicating one another as a result of it. I need to hurry. The third thing I want to mention tonight that has affected us as a brotherhood is the current movement by some people who are teaching things that are unscriptural and practicing things that are unscriptural. And I will label that under the real purpose, or what the real purpose of the Bible should be. I want to read to you very briefly an article that appeared in the newspaper in Nashville, Tennessee. Many members of the Churches of Christ are now beginning to believe that the New Testament is not just a book of laws and rules, but a book of love letters from Jesus Christ to the saints, one member said yesterday. Our relationship to God is on the basis of a covenant which before Christ was a covenant of laws, but now is a covenant of grace, whose only dynamic is love, author and publisher Carl Ketcherside says. Ketcherside, in Nashville to speak at the Belmont Church of Christ, said he formerly was a member of the Church of Christ, but in a crisis that occurred in Belfast, Ireland, I came to see that the theological hang-ups of my church did not make any sense to anyone else, only to persons who had grown up in that church. He described the traditional Churches of Christ members as people with legalistic minds who always have a sense of security when laws are laid down for them and they can avoid taking any responsibility. The author of three books, The Royal Priesthood, The Kingdom of the Messiah, The Death of the Custodian, Ketcherside said he is traveling and speaking for unity and church renewal among people of the Churches of Christ, Disciples of Christ, and the conservative Christian churches. There are very few people who read that article realized how far-reaching the teaching of Carl Ketcherside would eventually go. Carl Ketcherside was an interesting man, a dynamic man. He was a lovable man. He was a likable man. You could not meet him without liking him. You could not be around him without being impressed by him. I heard him preach many times. I was in his home. He came to hear me preach. I had a relationship. We wrote each other. Carl was a likable person. He had a brilliant mind. He was one of the best speakers I ever heard speak anywhere. I heard the entire debate when he met Flavel Colley in Dallas, Texas on the located preacher situation. The fact that he was so likable and the fact that he presented himself so well went a long way in getting into circles that otherwise he never would have been able to break. A lot of people thought that sooner or later that would all vanish away. We had some problems in the early 60s in the state of California with two or three churches that became enamored with that idea, and we lost them. And there were several members that we lost. Many of us believed that once that was eradicated and gone, the problem was gone, and it would not emerge again. But that was not the case at all. Carl Ketcherside was, of course, from the old Daniel Sommer movement. And he was the leader. He became the leader of that movement as he rose to power among that group of people. However, this trend that he started began to grow. It encroached some of the largest, what we would call, digressive churches of Christ in the country, and also Christian churches and Disciples of Christ. And it made inroads into our own brotherhood. Whether we like to admit that or not, it made great inroads into our own brotherhood, captivating people that we thought would never fall prey to doctrines like that or to practices like that. In the early 60s, few congregations chose to travel the road that eventually led them out of the brotherhood of which they had been a part for over 40 years. Brethren spoke out from the pulpit and printed page against those departures. Because of this, it appeared at the time that the movement itself was well contained, but that was not the case. Little by little, over the years, often underground, the ideas advocated by Ketcherside and others were taking roots in the minds of brethren in a number of places. The departures at first were subtle. Teaching was done privately. Certain ideas were advanced that soon began to take root, especially that the New Testament Scriptures was not a guidebook. The New Testament Scriptures was a collection of love letters. It was not a guidebook that taught us how to live or how we were to worship or how we were to carry on our work for the Lord. And that if we were to ever grow, we would have to change our approach in what we preached as well as in what we practiced. The ideas gradually advanced with departures from doctrine, the doctrine. We had people getting in pulpits preaching raw Calvinism. We had men who were claiming that baptism was not necessary for salvation, that we're saved by grace and by grace alone. All of that was an outgrowth of Ketcherside's theories. I well remember asking him one day, I said, tell me, he of course was opposed to the one-man pastor system, as he called it. He debated that on three or four, maybe five occasions. And I asked him, I said, now with all the changes you've made in your heart and in your mind, do you still believe it's wrong for a church to have a one-man pastor system? He said, yes, I do, but it just doesn't make any difference anymore. I believe it's wrong, but it doesn't make any difference anymore. And that really was the idea behind this movement. Differences should be overlooked. It really doesn't matter whether you use one cup or individual cup. Doesn't matter whether you have an instrument or you don't have an instrument. The thing that matters is, do you love one another? And do you behave as brethren in Christ? Now, among our numbers, we've had minor skirmishes, I think, in a number of places with people who have gotten off on this idea. And there have been a few that have been major. The church originally receiving the most attention among us was the church in Irving, Texas. Early on, some of their leaders admitted that they saw nothing wrong with classes in instrumental music. This has been 10 or 12 years ago. They told me that in the foyer of the building one day. One of their brethren told me, said, I'll be honest with you, I don't see anything wrong with Sunday school, and I don't see anything wrong with instrumental music. But no real advance toward the adoption of these innovations were made at that time. During this time, false ideas were coming from the pulpit regarding salvation by grace alone. Calvinism was really taught repeatedly. I heard it with my own ears, and there were many others who did as well. Finally, the situation became so unbearable that 50 brethren left because they could no longer tolerate what was being taught and practiced. At the invitation of those in that place at that time, five preachers, of which I was one of the preachers, went to the area and sought to bring about a reconciliation between the two groups. It's not that we had given up on anybody. We were trying our best to reconcile them as well as the truth. Those remaining at the Irving Church refused to meet and talk with us. They said, we're not interested. The others who had left realized that they had made some mistakes in the way they handled things, and they all made confessions. And we had prayer, with the hope that somehow we would be able to work through those problems and unity could once again be restored. During this period, one of the great losses that we suffered was our young people. We lost young people who went, some of them joined community churches because they felt like the church was not moving in that direction as fast as it should. Today, that same problem persists. Many of the young people are crying for more changes, greater changes, and they want it now because they're not satisfied with the way things are going. Some people felt that they were not moving fast enough, and they left on their own. In recent years, unfortunately, the gap has widened between those in that particular place and like congregations and the rest of the brotherhood from which they eventually came. There are about, so far as I can number, two or three groups in the state of Texas, at least two, perhaps in California, two or three in the state of Oklahoma, maybe a few more, but not many more. And so really in the grand scheme of things, when you talk about the number of churches that actually became involved in this division and this problem, they're not that great. What they taught, however, is much more far-reaching. It's much more far-reaching. And it appeals especially to the minds of young people because of some of the things that they are practicing and they are doing. Some who have adopted these ideas publicly declare salvation by grace alone and have come out publicly and preached, you don't have to be baptized to be saved. You can be baptized, but you're saved before you're baptized. Neither Sunday school classes or instrumental music are unscriptural. They stand by that. None, so far as I know, have adopted the use of a plurality of cups. Not because they believe it would be wrong, but because obviously they recognize it would not be advantageous to their cause at this particular time. I believe that will go, but it will be the last to go. In fact, none of them can never achieve mega church status until they do that. You're not going to have a mega church with hundreds of members and use one cup. It's just not going to happen. And they recognize that fact, I'm sure. This has affected but not destroyed the brotherhood of which most of us are a part. It has saddened many of us and will continue to do so in the years that lie ahead. There will come a time long after I'm gone, and some of you are gone, when those who maintain the faith will look back on these events and they will mark that as the beginning of a major departure from the Word of God that has affected the church. In fact, it is strange to me, and I want to make this confession tonight, it is strange to me that they have not joined some denomination or digressive church. I make you this promise. If I ever adopt what they believe, I'll be off to the Baptist church in a hurry. If I ever adopt what they believe, I'll either be off to a liberal Sunday school Church of Christ. I will not remain in this brotherhood and try to tear it apart. I will not remain among the churches among whom I grew up and try to destroy them by what I believe. All of them, so far as I know, admit there's nothing wrong with using one cup. And there's nothing wrong with an undivided assembly. And there's nothing wrong with singing praise to God. But because they're not satisfied to stay with that, they're willing to divide the church and cause people to leave. The bloodletting has not finished. But it seems clear that these few and those who parrot their ideas will never bring down the church or destroy the brotherhood of which they once were a part. What is the state of the church today? In view of our growth in this country, in view of the problems we face with division, in view of these new things that are being advocated in many places, what is the state of the church? First of all, I believe the church still stands. Is it wounded? Yes, it is. The church is wounded, and the church is hurt. Is it destroyed? No, and it never will be. Do we have battles yet to fight? Most certainly we do. Are the days going to be dark and dreary? Most certainly they will be. But in the words of Dr. Trott, the sun will shine again someday. There will come a day when the sun shines again. It may well be, brethren, the future of the church doesn't lie in America. It may well be the future of the church lies in some foreign land where people are still willing to walk miles to hear a gospel sermon. It may be that the future of the church lies in a place where the members don't have cars to drive and don't have tables that are spread with plenty. It may be that the future of the church lies in places where people have very little on which to subsist. But should that be the case, thanks be to God that those people are still here.